What's up, everybody? Welcome to a special bonus edition of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Today, we're going to talk to the man that defines the phrase veteran playmaker, Spurs point guard Andre Miller. That's next on the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
My next guest is in his third decade playing in the NBA, one of only a handful of players still playing from the class of 1999. And when you hear the phrase veteran playmaker, chances are somebody out there is talking about this guy. It's Andre Miller, the San Antonio Spurs guard, and he joins me here on the podcast. You ever think you'd make it this long, Andre? Third decade, 2016. You ever think you'd still be playing?
Well, I thought I'd still be playing. It was a goal. You know, I've been blessed. I've been injury-free, and, you know, I've kept it professional. So, you know, I'm blessed, and I'm enjoying the experience.
Was that the goal coming out of Utah? Was it just, I'm going to play until close to 40? I mean, did you have a idea in mind of how long you wanted to go?
Yeah, I had a goal. My goal was to play 15-plus years and play to 40 years old. You know, I'm pretty much at those goals. You know, of course, those were individual goals, you know, as a young guy, but you know, I also want to win a championship and, you know, just enjoy the experience and also to stay injury-free.
When was the last time you looked around the floor during a game and said, man, I've been around this league a long time?
Last night. You know, we played last night and, you know, I get an opportunity to sit on the side and observe some of the younger guys coming in and these talented young guys and polished point guards coming in, and just the NBA in general, just to see how the game has evolved and, you know, just how good the players are. You know, I get the opportunity to enjoy that. You know, my son is 16 years old, and he's had a chance to enjoy the experience also.
It certainly has evolved, and I'm curious, from when you came into the NBA in the late 1990s to where the game is right now, what are some of the bigger differences that you've seen?
Now, you know, with the hand checking rules, everybody's, you know, on the Steph Curry bandwagon and it's good for the NBA. And, you know, just the guys coming in and shooting all the three-pointers and off-balance shots. And, you know, it's not as physical as it was when I first came in. The older guys weren't as nice. You know, the guys that I looked up to growing up, you know, you come in and it's like you keep your mouth closed in the locker room and you pretty much had to learn on your own. Now I think guys are more helpful to the young guys as far as being available, and it's just kind of lending a helping hand on what it takes to be successful in the NBA. So off the court, it's kind of like that. And then on the court, it's just, you know, the game is a lot more faster. I mean, it was faster before, but you know, without the hand-checking rules, it's not as physical as it used to be.
Every player that plays as long as you've played has to kind of evolve into something different at some point. When was it in your career that you kind of evolved, maybe as the athleticism wasn't what it used to be? Can you pinpoint when you kind of evolved your game so that you could sustain it to this level this long?
I don't really think I've evolved. I think, you know, I think I've figured out ways to adjust, you know, losing a little bit of quickness, but I was never like the fastest point guard or the most athletic point guard. I think I had a good mixture of change of pace, and when I needed to get up and jump and get up in the air, then I did do it. But, you know, I don't think I've had to adjust too much. I think I've pretty much kept it simple. You know, one thing you got to be able to prove is that, you know, everybody can score the ball, but you have to find other things that you can do to help your team win. And I've always found a good balance between scoring and helping guys around me better. So I think that's where the longevity comes from, just being able to adjust to circumstances, knowing how to play defense and positioning and just making people around me better. That's the main thing.
You were a four-year guy at Utah. You don't see that in today's world. I mean, the good players, the top 10 prospects like you were, I mean, they're out after their first or occasionally their second year. What did you gain from being a player that went to college as long as you did?
Well, fortunately, I went to University of Utah and played for a great coach, Rick Majerus, who gave me the opportunity to learn how to play basketball. You know, he was a teacher, I was a student, and it wasn't just about basketball, it was about life experiences and just being able to enjoy the college atmosphere and then on the court just learning how to play basketball the right way. I played in a team atmosphere, and you know, that's what the college environment and college basketball is about anyway, you know, playing in a team environment, playing good team basketball and learning fundamentals. And that's something that, you know, a lot of these young guys that, you know, go to college and leave after a year, they don't have those fundamentals. So, you know, it's early on, you know, you have all the talent and athleticism, but as you get later on in your career, you don't know how to adjust because you don't have the fundamentals.
You got a favorite Rick Majerus story?
Well, you don't want to hear them. You know, but we have some crazy experiences, you know, when me and my college buddies get together. That's all we do is share Rick Majerus stories. You know, I could tell you, you know, about food. You know, he was an eater. So, you know, every time we went somewhere, he was always eating everything and hiding food behind the basket, you know, doing practice and stuff. But, you know, that's just some of the minor things that, you know, I experienced. You know, there's a lot of crazy stuff that went on.
Wait, he was hiding food behind the basket?
Yeah, you know, if we practiced, you know, he would have snacks, you know, behind the basket. You know, he'd take a break and go eat a Snickers or something. But that's just little stuff. That wasn't as funny as some of the other stuff I've experienced.
Oh, you're a guy that was, you know, he came from Los Angeles. I mean, how does a guy from Los Angeles adjust to a place like Salt Lake City? It's got to be a totally different type of environment. What was your adjustment like going from L.A. to Utah?
It was a culture shock. You know, I get out there, you know, Majerus came to Los Angeles and recruited me and, you know, offered me a scholarship right away. And that was the first offer I got, and I took it, and I get out there, and it's pretty much a culture shock, you know, but you know, everybody was nice, and I carried myself as a student athlete, and you know, didn't burn any bridges. Respected everybody that I met, and you know, after the first couple months, you know, I transitioned and adjusted pretty easy. You know, I enjoy Utah. I feel like it's a second home. You know, I still have friends there, but you know, it's definitely different than Los Angeles. You know, where I come from, so. You know, like I say, you know, I still stay in contact with some of my college buddies. And, you know, it was just probably the best experience that, you know, helped me get through life in general. Just going out there and experiencing all that helped me, you know, manage my way through the NBA and my career in life.
Yeah, I was going to say, did it help you in kind of a weird way to not be, you know, this incredibly hyped, incredibly recruited prospect? Did it provide you maybe with the motivation that maybe some other guys don't have to prove every day that you can compete at this level?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was always taught that, you know, my mom always taught me that, you know, you have to adjust to every circumstance that's thrown at you and, you know, don't back down. And, you know, you're going to have obstacles and challenges you got to deal with in life, and you can't walk away from them. You got to figure out how to get through them. And, you know, I had my ups and downs at Utah, and I just had to adjust. And like I say, you know, when you learn to adjust and, you know, deal with certain circumstances, you know, that makes you a better person. And I think that did. You know, it really doesn't matter what college you go to. You got to make the best of, you know, the situation, the cards that's dealt to you.
The best teammate you ever played with in the NBA?
Best teammate I ever played with in the NBA? Wow, I have a few of them. You know, I mean, I have some personal favorites. I enjoyed, you know, playing my Denver days. You know, I don't know. There's so many guys that I've crossed. You know, different personalities, and you know, guys that get a bad rap because their attitude, or you know, when you're around them in the locker room, they turn out to be good guys. You know, so it's a handful of guys that I've crossed, and also some crazy guys that I've crossed, but everybody has different personalities. You know, I can't really pinpoint one. You know, I'm trying to think of somebody that actually, you know, had an effect on me. And I would probably say early on, I would say Bimbo Coles, Mark Bryant. Those are two guys that I can remember early on when I first came in the NBA that kind of like not necessarily took me under the wing, but, you know, talk to me a little bit about basketball.
Who's somebody that got a bad rap in your mind but was actually a great teammate?
I think Carmelo Anthony. I think he gets a bad rap, you know, as you know, everybody calls him a selfish player. You know, everything that, you know, you see on the media, and now that he's with the New York Knicks, and, you know, you hear so many things that, you know, about him as far as not being a team player. I think it's the total opposite. I just think that, you know, he gets a bad rap. I consider him one of the best scorers to come through the league, and, you know, it's just the circumstances, the situations and the cards that he's been dealt, you know. I mean, this guy practiced every day. You know, he was competitive. And, you know, to win a championship and come in and help turn around a franchise that was, you know, just all over the place, you know, he still was getting a bad rap. So, you know, he definitely helped turn that franchise around, and they kind of disrespected him, you know. Just made him look bad as far as, you know, him saying he's a selfish guy and stuff. But for me, I thought, you know, he was a good teammate. I thought he was a hard worker. And, you know, every star has a selfishness about him, you know. So, you know, I think he just gets bad press for it.
You think the team didn't appreciate what he was back then as much as maybe they should?
I think in Denver, I think we had a great team. I think, you know, nowadays, you know, GMs and, you know, coaches or whoever makes the decision, they don't give the teams opportunity to gel. And they're so quick to make changes and adjustments to the team, you know. And like I said, you know, I played with a whole bunch of slow white guys in Utah, and we found a way to manage ourselves and go to a national championship, and we gelled and we understood how to play basketball. But then when you get to the NBA, you're so used to change and, you know, new players being cycled in and out, you know, the guys don't get an opportunity to gel. And that's why, you know, this situation over here in San Antonio, you can see why this team has won so many championships, because these guys have found a way to stick the nucleus together and build around them. So, you know, it's tough because it's a business, but, you know, in Denver, you know, if you let these guys, you know, gel, you know, anything can happen. You know, these people are so quick to make decisions to make a trade or make a splash deal instead of seeing what can help the team get better, letting the guys gel and experience ups and downs together.
You've been traded, I think, 4 times in your career. Was that Denver trade the toughest for you?
The first trade was tough because I felt that I was told that, you know, this was me and Carmelo's team, and that, you know, we were going to, you know, gel together. We'd have an opportunity to, you know, build this team and run with it. And, you know, to help that team turn around from however many wins they had to when they drafted Carmelo to making the playoffs the next year, you know, you just had to put in the right pieces. And I thought the pieces was there. And, you know, that was the first trade that I actually personalized. I took it personal. But then, you know, I was like, well, at least I was traded for a Hall of Famer. Yeah. You know, so that's how I looked at it. But, you know, it put me in a serious state as far as, you know, business before basketball. And after that, you know, everything was just business. I try not to let the politics, you know, get under your skin. And that's what a lot of guys tend to do. They lose their taste for basketball because, you know, business always is more important than the basketball part.
What was that like for you in December 2006? Not only do you get traded from a Denver team that, like you said, you thought that team was going somewhere, but you go to Philadelphia and you're basically replacing one of the greats of all time in that lineup. How strange was that for you that year?
It was strange, you know, because, you know, Denver was positioning ourselves for a playoff run. You know, of course, it's around Christmas time. So, you know, I took it real personal because it was close to Christmas. You know, that's the holidays and all that type of stuff. And then I get moved, and how I found out and how all that stuff works, you know. And then you go over to a team that basically, you know, at the bottom of the league. You know, I really personalized it, but I went over there with a professional attitude you know, stepped in the locker room as far as trying to be a leader. And I thought I did my job as far as, you know, helping turn that team around and reach the playoffs the next couple of years. And if I went over there, what was crazy is that year that I got traded there, if the team would have tanked the rest of the season in Philadelphia, they would have probably had an opportunity to draft a Kevin Durant or a Greg Oden.
Yeah.
So, you know, I personalize that a lot, and the main thing that I take pride out of is I help turn a young team around and help that team get to the playoffs the next couple of years. So that was a gratifying part.
Yeah, you did, no question, with that group. But you mentioned that, you know, that they had tanked or whatever, they could have gotten that player. Do you think tanking is a problem in the NBA today?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. You know, I know it's, you know, ways to rebuild team and you know, however that stuff works. You know, I've taken classes with business of basketball through the NBA Players Association and got an opportunity to meet some of the GMs. And you never know what's going on behind the scenes, but I don't think it's fair to all these guys that put in the hard work in the summer and during the season, you know, to try to have a successful season. And then, you know, of course, the management or whoever else is not going to tell you that they're going to tank the season. But I don't know how to say it, but, you know, I'm not going to say that they don't give a full effort as far as, you know, putting a solid team together. But these guys put in a lot of work, and they don't get nothing out of it. You know, it's basically like, oh, you guys go out there and let's see what you can do. You know, let's put all these 19, 20-year-olds. Let's see how you guys are going to do it. And you can't do that. You know, the kids aren't going to get any better. And they're going to lose confidence and learn how to develop a loser mentality. So I don't think it's fair.
Yeah, I see that too now. And people point to Philadelphia all the time and say that's the greatest example of tanking. But when you have a team like Orlando that's so used to losing that the losing culture can kind of become part of it, I think you're right. That's why it's important you got to win, or at least try to win as many games as possible, because you can't just flip a switch and all of a sudden become a winner, can you?
Exactly. I mean, a lot of these players that come into the NBA, they come in as winners and they come in as scorers. And, you know, a prime example, I was just in Minnesota before I got here, and, you know, you got a Kevin Garnett, you got a Tayshaun Prince, you got me, you got a Kevin Martin, and then you got a whole bunch of younger guys that really haven't experienced anything in the NBA, and they're so talented and they work so hard, and it's like they're getting a bad deal because, you know, you throw them out there, you throw five 19 to 22-year-olds out there to play against men and try to compete for a playoff spot. And, you know, you want to teach them the right way, but then you throw them out there and they just get ate up. And it's not fair towards them because they're working hard. They're working hard in practice. And then you throw them out there and let them learn like some lost puppies. You know what I mean? You put Luke. If you don't have a parent or somebody to teach these guys, you know, on the job, you know, you gotta put them in, mix them in with the veterans, and let them learn together instead of just throwing them out there by themselves and allowing them to develop a losing mentality. So, you know, that Minnesota was a prime example, and those guys was great over there, but I don't think it's fair towards them that they work so hard and then you throw them out there without any help.
Does being traded ever not suck?
Well, trading sucks. Being traded sucks, period. You know, I wanted to spend, you know, after my second go-round going back to Denver, I wanted to finish my career in Denver because I considered it a home base. But there's certain times where players feel that, you know, they're not appreciated or they're disrespected, or management or coaching staff find a way to get under a player's skin to, you know, get them to react. And the player feels disrespected. What does he do? Do he speak up or do he keep his mouth closed? And the times that where I've spoken up and I thought I was right and I've earned the right to speak up, I was moved just by being a veteran. And I don't think that's why you don't see as many veterans in the NBA anymore, because the management and the coaches don't want that type of voice in the locker room. because they feel that they have control of the locker room. So, you know, it's cool to say, yeah, we have a veteran. You know, he's going to help the young guys. He's good for the locker room. But I think they don't want that. I don't think managements and coaches, they want that. You know, it's too much control, and the young guys are going to follow behind the older guys because we set the example. So that's where the veterans get upset about, you know, because, you know, we don't get an opportunity to influence these kids.
Do you think there's some insecurity there on the part of coaches and management that they want their voice to be the only one that's really being heard by these impressionable 20, 21, 22-year-olds, and maybe a veteran voice might perceive that as being something that would interfere with that?
Well, I mean, I don't know what goes on the other side, but, you know, like I say, you don't try to get caught up in the politics and the business, but, you know, it's not fair for an 18, 19, 20-year-old to come into the NBA and, you know, you don't have a veteran, 3 or 4 veterans, you know, to help him with that transition. And it's tough. It's a thin line because, you know, the thing that's most important is winning. That's the main thing in the NBA. That's how guys get paid, is by winning. But, you know, the business part is actually the most important part of basketball. So, you know, you got a lot of guys that come in very talented, very good, that lose their taste for basketball because business, they not used to the politics in the business. And that's pretty much taken over, you know, at all levels, all the way down to AAU basketball or high school basketball to, you know, when these kids start picking up a baseball bat or a football or any sports. So it kind of sucks.
How long do you think it's going to take those young guys in Minnesota to figure it out? Now that they're all kind of together and that's the team they're going to have for the next few years, what's the learning curve for that team?
Well, I mean, how I see it is, you know, I think all these kids should stay in college because that's going to make the NBA better. You know, I think, how can I explain it? You know, these guys got to come in and they have to know what's going on. And owners and GMs, they don't want a polished player. They want somebody that can mold and develop. And that's how GMs and coaches make a name by themselves, is by developing and molding the player. So they rather take a player that they can develop and take credit for than take a polished player that actually knows how to play basketball. So, you know, it's a thin line, like I say. You know, as far as Minnesota and some of these teams that put all these young guys and, you know, 19, 20-year-old guys together and say that they want to develop them, well, they developing them for other teams because in 2 years, they just going to start shuffling the deck and moving players around. So, you know, it's best, I think, to put the best product out there. You get a good team, you get a team, and you put your best product out there and put your best foot forward, and then you go from there. And unfortunately, that's not how it works in the NBA. And, you know, you get, now that I'm here in San Antonio, I get a chance to see how a franchise, you know, has their players that stick together, the management stick together, everybody stick together, and they're a team. Nobody is left out. Everybody is involved. And that's why they've had so much success throughout the years.
What's Andre Miller want to do when his career is over?
I mean, I've left my options open. You know, I've been involved with the NBA Players Association as far as, you know, the top 100 camp, as far as that bringing, you know, these high school kids in. I did that 1 year, enjoyed that experience. You know, a lot of people say, well, you should go in and transition into coaching. You know, I just kind of leave my options open. You know, people have brought up management. And, you know, my thing is just to learn as much as I can on every level, you know, and hopefully that can help me transition into something. But my passion has always been, you know, being able to affect a young kid, you know, to make a difference in his life, because there's a lot of kids out there that don't have a role model or somebody in their ear pointing them in the right direction. At the NBA level, these guys are coming in, and they're, you know, I mean, these guys come from tough backgrounds, different cultures, and never had the opportunity to have somebody say, here's $1 million, here's $2-5 million, and it's tough. And that's what the Players Association is for, to help these young guys. So my passion is pretty much, you know, kids and youngsters and helping them navigate their ways through tough situations and life experiences.
When was the last time one of these young kids looked at you on the floor and tried to just blow by you? Thought that you, because you were your age and you weren't as fast as them, they just tried to go around you?
Whenever I step on the court, you know, the last few years it's been fun. I've enjoyed it, but you know, at the same time, you know, I still look at myself as a competitor and a guy. You know, if I'm on the court, I can make things happen. No matter if I was 45 years old or 20 years old. So, you know, it's funny to see how the younger guys will come in and I get in the game and their eyes get bigger. Their eyes get bigger and they're like, you know, that's just a part of the business that comes with the territory. And I enjoy it. I enjoy the challenge. And you know, I think, you know, I feel that I can still compete on any level. I can still get out there for 25, 30 minutes and be effective and help a team win a basketball game. So, you know, I've had my time to shine, and I think the longevity has come for me as far as being able to keep my ego in check and knowing where I'm at in my career and being able to adjust. So, you know, I take pride in that.
I bet Zach LaVine tried to go at you in practice all the time.
Oh, yeah. You know, I enjoyed him and Tyus and Ricky, you know, because we, you know, from the first day I got there, you know, we challenged each other in practice. You know, I try to pick those guys up full court. They'll try to pick me up full court, you know. And that's what practice is for, you know, to challenge the player in front of you. And you want to take his spot. You want to be the number one guy at your position. And that's something that I tried to, you know, come in and instill in Minnesota, you know, with the point guards, with Tyus and Zach. You know, you don't want to settle for being a backup. You want to settle for being the man that makes things happen. And you're only going to make your team better by challenging the guy in front of you. And I think we lose that as far as, you know, going into training camp. You know, it's like, oh, well, he's the starting point guard. He's the starting shooting guard. He's the starting small forward. He's the starting center. And there's no competition. There's no competition. Everything is entitlement. And here you go. You're the starter. Let's see what you can do. And that's something that's changed over the years.
Before I let you go, I heard a story about you in Minnesota, and you got to tell me if this is true, that after practice sometimes you go over to the YMCA or whatever gym is nearby and play pickup?
That's not true.
Okay.
That's not true, man. You probably heard a lot of stories about me, but I did that, like, when I first got to Minnesota. I got there the last 3 or 4 years, the teams that I played for, I get to the city a couple weeks early, and, you know, nobody's really paying pickup ball. So, you know, I'll go find a gym where, you know, some old guys, you know, I don't care if they, you know, 4 feet tall or, you know, 70 years old, you know, just to go up and down the court and, you know, get a workout in. And I did that a couple times when I first got to Minnesota, and then I stopped.
Do the old guys know who you are when you're playing against them?
Yeah, they do. They do. You know, and they don't trip off of it. They don't, you know, it's fun to say, you know, oh, well, hey, man, you know, we played with him. We played against him. And, you know, I end up taking a couple pictures afterwards. And, you know, man, it's some good guys out there that can play basketball, that probably play high school basketball or college basketball. So, you know, I go play basketball anywhere if anybody will tell you, you know. So it doesn't matter, you know, what color you are or how old you are or how fat or slow or whatever you want to call it. Everybody, you know, you get on that court, anything can happen.
You got to be excited about this year, too. I mean, you've been to the playoffs a whole bunch of times, but I think only out of the first round once, right?
Yeah, I got out the first time once with the Wizards.
Was that your motivation to go to San Antonio, knowing that the history there, there's a pretty good chance that you can make a run?
Yeah, for the most part, you know, the opportunity was, you know, it came up and I was cool with it. You know, my main thing was if this was to be my last year, you know, there's no way I was going to sit in Minnesota on a team that doesn't have any goals. From what I saw, you know, just to, you know, I didn't want to sit there and let this be my last year. You know, there was no expectations in Minnesota with that team and which way they wanted to go as far as winning, and it wasn't communicated. So, you know, I was like, you know, if this was my last year, I can't go out like this. So at least I want to go somewhere where I get an opportunity to be on a playoff team and make a run.
You think this is your last year?
I'm not going to say. You know, I mean, I'm enjoying it, you know, and I could keep going. But, you know, like I said, there's other things that are more important, you know, as far as, you know, life after basketball. And I want to experience those things. And, you know, I think I've had a productive and a great NBA career by my standards. And, you know, it might be time to move on, but I'm not going to say it.
Well, Andre, it's been great to talk to you. I really appreciate you taking some time here, and I hope you get that deep playoff run this year with San Antonio. Thanks for coming on.
All right, thank you very much.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
My thanks to Andre Miller. Earlier this week, we recorded the latest episode of The Two-Man Game, the Vertical's video web series, which included an interview with newly acquired Hornets guard Courtney Lee and the Vertical front office insider Bobby Marks and I discussing how the Knicks are developing Kristaps Porzingis, the Cavs' seeming disinterest in the number one seed, and the Stick'em situation with Dwight Howard in Houston. Take a listen. Joining me now on set is one of the best two-way guards in the NBA, 8-year NBA veteran, Charlotte Hornets guard, Courtney Lee. Seven teams? How many teams in 8 years now, Courtney?
Six.
Six? Yeah. Does getting traded ever get easier for a guy in your position?
Well, after the first one, it does, because after that initial shock of being traded the first time and coming from college where you know you're going to be there for 4 years if you do all four. And so after the first time, you get adjusted to it and start to understand that it's a business also. And so you understand that there will be movement and whatnot. If you're not like the main guy on the team, there's a good chance you will be traded. So
the truth is, though, everywhere you get traded, the team gets better because of you. And the Charlotte Hornets are the same way, averaging about 9.5 points in almost 30 minutes per game. The numbers for Charlotte indicate that you guys are significantly better since you've come around. What have you been able to add to this team in the short time that you've been there?
Just the guy that's just going to play hard on both ends of the court. Like you said, I'm going to go out there and compete on the defensive end. And on the offensive end, I offer spacing and shot-making capabilities.
Let's go back to that first trade.
Yeah.
You were in Orlando. You go to the finals. You get traded to a New Jersey team that wins 12 games the next year. Walk me through how that experience, even though you did win 12 games, made you mature and kind of learn, you know, the life in the NBA, kind of in an advanced stage here.
Yeah, like I said, after that first trade, I grew as a person and a player and understood that it's a business also. I didn't understand the move at first, but then as the year went on, I started to understand what Orlando wanted to do and what New Jersey wanted to do. And it being a rebuilding year, it was definitely tough. And like you said, winning 12 games was never fun, but I got to grow as a player, playing with those guys and going through that. And I think it helped me in my career.
You've now played for Steve Clifford twice, first as an assistant with the Orlando Magic and now as the head coach in Charlotte. He's got a terrific defensive reputation. You're one of the better defenders at your position. What is it about his defenses that maybe are a little bit different than some of the other ones that you've played for?
I think a lot of them are similar. I mean, you know, the NBA game is majority pick and roll, and it's just about the defensive schemes and rotations. But I just think with him, he focuses in on attention to details. He's a great communicator. He walks the players through everything, and he wants to make sure that it's right. And in shoot-arounds, he's out there walking through every play himself, and the assistant coaches chime in at times, but he's pretty much hands-on.
Do you like that? Do you want your coach to be as hands-on as a guy like Steve is, or do you prefer the opposite of it, as some coaches prefer to do, which is to back off a little bit more?
I think most players would prefer the head coach to be more hands-on. I mean, you just see a guy like him going out there, putting all the work in film sessions and getting us prepared to play against the opponent that you have to lock in at the same level and go out there and make sure you don't mess up, because he's putting in countless hours watching film and with the coaches, assistant coaches, and making sure we're prepared.
You've only missed 10 games in 3 years. How much pride do you take in your off-court work, your work during the summer, and just being on the court, you know, and having your team rely on you every night?
Yeah, I try not to get injured. I mean, it's kind of a blessing that you don't.
You're doing well with that. You're doing really well with that.
Like you said, as you grow as a player and the longer you play this game, you understand taking care of your body is just as important as making a shot. So you make sure you get your treatment before and after practice, and in the off season, make sure you get rest and not do anything too crazy.
It seems like, numbers-wise, there's a lot of parity in the Eastern Conference right now. You know, you're bunched in there with three or four teams fighting for anywhere from third to sixth. Even at the top, it seems like the top teams are a little more vulnerable this year than they've been in years past. Is that an accurate assessment of where you think the Eastern Conference is, that it's a little evenly matched this year, maybe in years past?
I think so. Like you said, the guys from teams from the third to the sixth spot are neck and neck right there. So it's definitely more competitive in the Eastern Conference. Like you said, you have two teams with the Cavs and Toronto who have a little bit separation from the third seed, but everybody else is competing.
Is there a difference in how teams look at the Cavaliers this year? I mean, last year they were going into the playoffs with enormous momentum. They had won a big winning streak going into the postseason. This year, a little bit different for them now. Do you perceive them a little differently, that maybe they're a little more vulnerable this year than perhaps they were at this time last year?
Well, last year they had a rolling, even with the injuries and whatnot. And this year, I mean, every team is going through their ups and downs, and some teams are at their ups at the right time, and some teams, like you said, the Cavaliers, they're having their little issues right now. And so that just gives everybody else a sense of hope and just a feeling that on any given night we'll be able to compete with those guys.
13-4 since they've acquired you. Any similarities to this Charlotte team to the teams you were in Memphis and Houston?
I would say a team that I would compare the Charlotte team with is the one in Orlando, just because it's the similar styles on both ends of the court with Steve Clift and just the personnel. Well, guys, you got pretty much anything with Kemba Walker, who's the playmaker and can score. Nick is the same way and loves to pass the ball. And you got guys that come off the bench with Jeremy Lin, just like last night. You see him back to Lin's sanity. So I think the personnel is definitely similar to that team.
You're a defender. The least favorite player for you to defend?
Least favorite player? I would have to say it had to be either Klay Thompson or J.J. Redick. And it's just because those guys are not ISO players. They're just players that's going to keep you on the move the whole time. So there's no time that you can just think that you can relax on the possessions, because they're going to run you off four or five picks.
So you'd rather face a guy that's posting you up more, it's more stationary than perhaps the guy you've got to chase around screen after screen every single time?
I would love to guard a guy that I know is going to come to the block and just try to give me his move, or a guy that wants to ISO. And so instead of running nonstop, because once you get hit with some of those picks, it kind of hurts, and then you also get tired.
You'll be a free agent this summer. What are you looking for? What are the requirements or the, you know, something that you're looking for to kind of put your roots in, you know, if it's either in Charlotte again or in your next home?
Just a good all-around group as far as management, coaching staff, and a good locker room. And Charlotte has all of that right now. But other than that, just a good situation for myself to go in and be able to help a team ultimately compete for a championship.
What do the players think about what this summer is going to look like? The money is going to explode. It's expected to be a free agent free-for-all with all the teams with salary cap space. What do the players talk about when it comes to this specific summer?
Well, if you're a free agent right now, you're in a good spot, so the players are talking about that. But if you're not, it's kind of one of those things where I'll be happy for my teammates and happy for you if you get a nice deal or whatnot. But I know for me, man, I'm just going in with an open mind. Just like I said, with the offseason, want to take care of my body and rest and just let my agents and the teams do all the negotiating and whatever happens, happens. But like I said, I just want to fall in a good situation, not only for myself, but for that organization also.
Before we let you go, you've been on a bunch of teams, obviously. The confidence level of this Charlotte team, how does it compare as you head towards the postseason to the confidence level of maybe some other teams that you've been on that have been to the playoffs?
It's right there with them. I mean, we feel that we can beat anybody on any given night, and everybody's been playing well, and we're hitting a peak right now, and we're trying to ride that momentum all the way into the playoffs.
Courtney Lee does not like to get run off screens.
Yes, sir.
Get that covered. Courtney, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Bobby, good stuff from Courtney Lee, but I want to talk now about the New York Knicks, specifically Kristaps Porzingis and the way that Kurt Rambis has utilized him. There's been some talk within the Knicks organization, you know, don't shoot so much Kristaps. Maybe they're going to play him a little bit at the three, small forward position. What do you think of the way that Porzingis has been coached under Rambis as opposed to perhaps Derek Fisher?
Well, I'm concerned, and my concern is that there are going to be some bad habits that are creeping in right now. You know, the Knicks are 6-21. Since end of January. Porzingis has kind of hit the rookie wall, and his play of late has not been what we saw in early December, mid-January here. And I have a lot of concerns with Porzingis and where we're going right now.
Yeah, look, I think playing him at the small forward position is insane. I think he is best equipped to play the center spot. I think going forward, forget the triangle offense. The best offense for Kristaps Porzingis is whatever offense that Rick Carlisle ran for Dirk Nowitzki with the Dallas Mavericks. That system would seem to fit exactly what Porzingis is. I think he's a 5 in the long term, not a 3. They should be looking at him at power positions and manipulating him against other big men in the NBA, not putting him against smaller players.
Well, I agree. And how the league is, especially now, him at the 5 is perfect. I understand that, you know, there are times when you get a Dwight Howard, you know, down low and you might have to change up your roster. My other concern is the rotating door in New York. You know, we're likely going to probably see a new coach, and it's almost going to be this year is a wasted year. Yes, we had the flash of Porzingis in November and December, but we're going to go back to square one, you know, come July with a new coach and a new staff and also a new philosophy.
Yeah, I don't think there's ever been a more important hire in New York than who that next head coach is for the next few years, who's going to be tutoring Kristaps Porzingis. All right, I want to move on to the Cleveland Cavaliers. I was in Minnesota where the Golden State Warriors expressed urgency, strong urgency to maintain their position atop the Western Conference to keep that number one overall seed. In the Eastern Conference, you've heard Tyronn Lue say this week that, you know, we want the number one seed, but we're going to prioritize making sure our guys are rested and ready for the postseason over going relentlessly after it over the final few weeks of the season. What do you make of that decision by Tyronn Lue?
I don't buy it. I don't buy it one bit. And if you are going for the number one seed, you go for it. I understand there's a time where you do need to rest their players. But if you look at their schedule down the stretch, they have one more back-to-back, and it's this week. They've got a relatively soft schedule. I was in Toronto during the playoffs in Brooklyn, and I know how loud that building gets. And the last thing you want to do is go on the road in the Eastern Conference Finals for 4 games and try to steal a game there. And to have home court, which Cleveland right now does, that's what their goal should be.
Look, one thing about this team is that I think there is a sense of arrogance in the locker room that, you know what, we're not playing great right now, but our talent level is still superior to that of the Raptors. It's better than Boston. It's better than Miami. We may not get home court advantage, but we're still so much better than everybody else that is going to carry the day. Now, they may be right. That could be true. I mean, it's different than the Western Conference because Cleveland versus Toronto is different than Golden State versus San Antonio. But you're right, they better be careful because the Raptors, they're coming out swinging in a potential conference final series. They believe they can beat the Cavaliers in 2 out of 3. And if the Cavs aren't sharp, that's a Toronto team that can win a series against Cleveland.
Well, if they think they can turn that flip switch on come playoff time, they're going to be in for a dogfight even in the first round. And we haven't even talked about Miami, you know, the team that they lost to by 20 over the weekend. And they're in for a dogfight no matter, you know, where we go the end of the season. But they've got to stay sharp. I liked what they did against Denver. You know, they kind of spread out their minutes. And, you know, I understand Denver's going to the lottery. But if they can kind of follow that blueprint for the next, you know, 10 to 12 games, they should be in the number one seed.
The other thing, too, is that they're trying to reinvent themselves in some ways. They're trying to become a play smaller type of team. You would think they'd want to do everything they can to put that group of players together, to get as many minutes together as you possibly can. I'm not sure I buy the idea that they're going to be taking it easy over the last couple of weeks of the season.
Well, when you're looking for your identity at Game 7, you're in trouble. I don't care if you have LeBron James, Kyrie Irving, or Kevin Love. When you're still searching and you're mixing and matching different lineups, you're going to set yourself up for failure come the spring.
Yeah, we could be looking at the last couple of months of Kevin Love, too. If this doesn't work out for Cleveland, I wouldn't be surprised at all to see a roster shakeup at the end of the season. Finally, I want to talk about Stick'em-gate. Let's call it that. Stick'em-gate, right? Dwight Howard using an illegal substance on his hands. The NBA's come out, sent a memo across the league saying, guys, this is not a legal substance. No fine, no suspension for Dwight Howard. Was the memo enough? And what do you make of Dwight's decision to put that stuff on his hands?
I'm fine with the memo. You know, in the operations manual and in the NBA rules, it's kind of you're in a gray area. It's not cut and dry. Now,
why is that, though? Why is it not specifically noted that you can't use a particular product?
I think because we have never seen a situation like this. And usually what happens is you always put a rule in when something happens. And there's, you know, players use rosin, you know, throughout the game, the powder you see at the scorer's table. The Howard situation is bizarre. And I am all for him, you know, not getting suspended or fined. But if you watch the tape again, there is no reason for him to get the ball, rub his hands on the ball, and then give it to the ref to give to Paul Millsap. That's why he got caught. And it's almost like he was crying for help. You know, he wanted to get caught to draw attention to himself, and he did.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because I talked to one player who had not heard about what Dwight did, and he asked me, he said, what happened with Dwight Howard? I said, and before I could answer him in a text message, he texted back, let me guess, he put too much on his hands, it got all over the ball, and somebody complained. So this happened in a very Dwight type of way. You know, I don't know other players would put as much of that substance on their hands and let it get on the ball. One thing about Houston, though, it's not a capital crime. It's not, you know, the greatest infraction in the NBA today, but it was cheating. They got caught cheating, and they're busted for it. I think that needs to be said in this whole thing.
Well, it's never about the crime. It's always about the cover-up.
Yeah.
You know, and if you watch the footage as far as, you know, the tape over the, you know, the bottle that they used to spray, you know, I understand it's, you know, tape that you know, spray that you use to tape your ankles. You know, J.B. Bickerstaff kind of hiding in his jacket and kind of the process afterward. That's where a lot of people that I've talked to yesterday around the league have an issue with, is the actual cover-up. It's not with Dwight. Everybody does it. He just went to the extreme, is that how they, you know, handle the process right there.
All right, good stuff. Bobby Marks, I'm Chris Mannix. Don't forget to join us here next week on the Two-Man Game here on The Vertical. That's it for the special bonus edition of The Vertical Podcast. Remember, you can download this episode and more on Stitcher, TuneIn, really anywhere you can download podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. Make sure you also check out The Vertical Podcast with Woj and The Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick as well.